welcome into another episode of a Colorado Craft Podcast by Mile High Bourbon and Rye. My name is Zach, and I am the host of the show. If you guys are new to this show, this is all about anything made in Colorado, focused in Colorado, crafted in Colorado. Today, I am extremely excited to be sitting down here at Burns Family Artisan Ales with Laura and Wayne. Laura and Wayne, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Cheers.
Yeah, looking forward to this. Beer's delicious. I already had some of this German Pilsner, and I gotta say, so we're recording this one in basically August. We'll have it, it's gonna release probably a little bit later, so it's gonna be cooler by the time this releases, but it is hot today, and this Pilsner hits the spot. It is
98 degrees, I believe.
Yeah, my car read 103 at one point as there I was driving up from work, and I was like, that's too much, man. I can't do that, so.
A lot.
But thank you guys so much for having me. We're down here basically in the heart of downtown Denver, just a little south of 8th Avenue if you take that exit off I-25, so come check them out down here. Let's talk a little bit about Burns Family. How'd you guys get started? How'd this kick off?
Well, he's been brewing for a long time.
I have. yes, I started brewing for a living professionally, 33 years ago now? I was a home brewer prior to that, so I've been doing this for really most of my professional life. Went to brewing school both here and in Germany back in the early 90s and mid-90s, and yeah, I've worked at a number of breweries. I spent the first shy 20 years of my career in Michigan, where we both grew up. And then the last, I guess, what are we now, 13 years and counting in Denver, I think? Yeah. So, yeah.
That's awesome. Wait, so you went to school in Germany to learn how to brew beer.
That is true.
That's got to be, like, the best spot in the world, it seems like, to learn how to brew beer, right?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to cast any stones at any other country's excellent brewing education services, but certainly there are some outstanding brewing institutes, universities in Germany.
Yeah.
I think that's fair to say.
Okay. That's a very good way to put that. I just, you know, when you think Germany, especially if you've been in the industry, you're definitely thinking beer for sure. Like, they've got a lot of really good beer that comes out of that country, so.
I think that's fair. I do believe that's a very fair thing to say.
So when did you guys start, or when did you start Burns Family?
6 years ago, almost, to the day, August 18th of 2018. And,
we opened to the public.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. We opened to the public.
The company had been around for a while before that, yeah. As we're putting things together.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
No,
that's when we started. Yeah. and in this lovely space in Val Verde district of Denver, we were able to take over this space from a brewery that was here formerly that it had decided to move in with another brewery. So you know, as brewers tend not to make a ton of money. we were able to get in for what was in our wheelhouse and get started brewing for the public. So 6 years here, we have expanded to a second location 10 months ago. So so that's fun and, you know, allows us to kind of feel like we're making an impact on the Denver community. And yeah, so here making beers. We've got 12 taps that we do here, but one of the major programs that we do is his forte is doing double digit high strength beers as well as really tasty lower strength beers. This is an award winning pils that we're drinking. And so one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we have part of our portfolio with was to do these double strength, double digit high alcohol beers, and we put those in bottles, and so that's a large part of our program as well.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about because the barrel aging obviously is where you're getting a lot of those double digit strength beers from, of course. So well, first, I guess, how did you end up deciding that was kind of your, how did you discover that that was your wheelhouse, that's what you wanted to do?
Sure. Well, when I started homebrewing in the late 80s and early 90s with a good friend of mine, we were fascinated by just the world of beers that was out there, and we found most exciting a number of the strong beers from different brewing traditions, whether they were more or less British, more or less continental German, or German-influenced, or, say, Belgian-influenced. And it's probably fair to say, in hindsight, we didn't fully understand it at the time, because all of these beers were coming from Europe. There were almost no breweries, craft breweries. I mean, the number of craft breweries in the country was less by far than the number of craft breweries in Colorado today.
Yeah.
In, you know, in the entire country, there were far less than there are currently in Colorado. So getting beer from craft breweries was kind of a sidelight afterthought. It was almost unavailable. So we were, any of our specialty beers that we were reading about or drinking were largely coming, you know, from around the world, largely Europe. And we found all of them fascinating. We didn't fully understand the impact that packaging, time, shipping, transportation could have on, say, a regular strength beer like a German Pilsner that might not taste at its best any longer sometime later in another continent. And however, beers that are bigger and stronger tend to endure that a little more gracefully. And so I think we immediately, and also we were young, so we were excited about exciting big numbers and things.
Well, yeah.
And so we were especially excited about big, strong beers from any of these various brewing traditions. So we started homebrewing and trying to recreate some of these things that were, we could read about them in books, like Michael Jackson's various works and things like this.
Okay.
And, but we never imagined the way that specialty beers would grow in the market. In
yeah.
the late 80s to early 90s, we didn't have any imagination that even just 5 or 10 years later, you could potentially go to a local specialty beer store and pick and choose between 500 or 1,000 different brands. That we never had that idea. So our thought was, well, we'd read about these beers. It's like, well, that sounds amazing, but yep. unless we whatever win the lottery and start traveling around the world just to drink beer, so we're assuming that's not going to happen, we're never going to get to try these things. So the only way to try to taste something that sounds like these really fascinating things is if we try to recreate something similar ourselves.
Okay.
So we started homebrewing, and we tried a lot of different things, but in particular, we tried to recreate some of these strong beers. So it really goes back to the late 80s, trying to play with higher alcohol fermentations, things like this. When I did make the transition into being a professional brewer, one of the people I happened to go to school with is a guy who was, at the time, he and his father were the owner of a very well-known place that is no longer an independent brewery, but they are basically the people who started the concept of bourbon barrel aging strong imperial stouts.
Okay.
Given that I was from Michigan and this guy was from within a state or so away, it's not too hard to make the guess where in, say, a big city in Illinois he might have been from. But I went to brewing school with him, and he was talking with me about how he was thinking about, I'm thinking about doing this thing. And I bought a whole bunch of empty bourbon barrels, like a truckload of them. And I'm making a huge batch of strong imperial stout, and I'm going to put it in that for several months. And then I'm going to take it back out and package it. No one was doing this, like, to my knowledge, anywhere ever
yeah.
for, like, clean fermented beers.
Yep.
Aging them in wood at this time in the mid-late 90s. No one was doing that. There were some places doing wood fermentation aging of wild sour beers.
Yep.
Wild and or sour or both. But in terms of taking, like, a, quote, clean beer and aging it in a barrel just to get the barrel character into a, quote, clean beer, to my knowledge, no one was doing that. And so when he said that to me, I was like, That's interesting. What are you thinking about there? What are you looking for in that? And he said, well, not quite sure, but I do know that if it doesn't work, my dad's going to be really pissed at me because it's going to be a really expensive, bad experiment.
Yeah.
It worked out just fine for them. It, as again, for anyone who's gathered who this is, it's really obvious. But they're still making it in large quantity today, even if they are owned by a giant foreign company. But in any case, that sort of sparked my thoughts and my experimentations with strong fermentations to, okay, what if I started playing with that? So in the mid-late 90s, I started playing in that vein as well.
Okay.
And improvements in, there was this thing called the internet that was starting to become available too, so that was nice. But new knowledge, new understandings, and, you know, crossovers from, like, sake fermentations, which are, sake is technically beer, it's fermented grain.
Yeah.
And even though most folks would not suggest that it really tastes very much like a beer you would recognize, but technically it's a beer. But it's a very high alcohol, potentially, beer. And so looking at things like that, just trying to better understand the stresses, what causes a yeast to go from, I'm in a happy place, I love doing this stuff, to, oh, I'm kind of struggling now, and I think maybe I'm going to take a piece out and shut down.
Yeah.
And trying to better understand that sort of stuff. So reading an awful lot of information on these topics and then starting to experiment with some of the yeast strains that were becoming available. And so then that led to me sort of more aggressively pursuing beers that were stronger than, say, 8 to 13%, which at the time, Sam Adams did their first really strong beer, which in its current iteration is Utopia, but its first iteration was in 94.
Okay.
And they pushed the ABV to 17%. But prior to that, the strongest beer in the world for some years had been a beer very well known out of, at the time, Switzerland. Now the brand is owned by a company in Austria called Samichlaus, and it was about 14%. That was very well known as the strongest beer in the world.
Yeah.
At 14%. So I was trying to push, I was really close to what people were getting to, and so I was really excited about that. And then all of a sudden Sam Adams comes on and releases a beer in 94 that's 17%.
I was like, yeah.
Holy cow, okay. You can go farther. You can find a path. And so then I got more intrigued by trying to experiment with it more, as well as my friend doing this thing with the wood barrel aging. So all these various pieces started to come together in my mind, and I started playing with that more and more. I was fortunate enough to work for various companies over the years that were, to one degree or another, either passively or very actively supportive of that.
Okay.
Because on the surface, it doesn't sound like the most profitable approach to making beer.
Not for beer, no.
You know, it takes months or years to even have a product to sell.
Yeah.
Versus you can make a delicious amber ale or pale ale or pilsner or IPA within a few weeks to a couple to 3 months.
Yep.
Well, or you could make this really expensive liquid that you've got to wait a year or two or three to be able to even make a penny on.
Yep.
That's a tough pitch to any business owner. And they were very accommodating of me finding time to experiment and do that stuff.
That's awesome.
So so I experimented with it quite a bit through the mid-90s into the early to mid-aughts. And by that time, I was having success pushing alcohol contents consistently into the upper teens.
Okay.
I cracked 20% a couple of times, and so
impressive.
And that's fermentation. So, there are probably people who might be watching this saying, "Yeah, but beer has gotten up to 36%." It's true that it is beer, but it is also true that that beer has been iced, so it is ice beer. And icing your beer removes liquid from it, so it is a form of distillation. So it's not truly a fermented product at that point. I mean, it's sometimes delicious and wonderful, but as a point of pride, there aren't very many brewed fermented beers that are above, I don't think any of them have reached above 30%. Sam Adams Utopias has gotten to 27, I think.
Yeah, 27 or 8 is the strongest we're aware of for something that is purely fermented. I mean, a couple of places, there's one or more places in Germany, they have really long names, so I can't remember their names. And I apologize in advance to their, I guess not in advance, but still to those folks. Can't remember their names. The other one that's really easy to remember is BrewDog. Yep. They've pushed the alcohol content over 60% by doing the ice beer thing.
Okay.
But alcohol freezes at a colder temperature than water.
Yep.
So if you chill a beer down below the freezing point of water, but above the freezing point of ethyl alcohol, you get water ice forming, but not alcohol
ice. But the alcohol is still separate, yeah.
And so then if you do that freezing and then you transfer the liquid out and leave the ice behind, effectively it's freeze distillation, concentrating the beer and the flavors and the color and all these things, which is a wonderful history thing. It's technically illegal in the U.S., but ice box in Germany are a long history thing, and it produces a more concentrated, intense aroma, flavor, body, and it's a wonderful thing. But in any case, that's the process that these folks have used to push the alcohol content up very high. I got the good fortune of talking with a guy at that place in Scotland back in 2010, and the Tactical Nuclear Penguin, which was 32%.
I remember that beer.
It was a 10% Imperial Stout fermented.
Yeah.
And then they freeze concentrated it up to 32%. So making a 10% Imperial Stout is still a big beer, but it's not earth-shakingly amazing. It's just, it's a big beer.
Yeah. And to make a point of clarification, ice beer is legal if you have a distiller's license in the United States.
Yeah. Neat.
So,
okay.
Yes.
It's the U.S. considers it to be legally distillation.
Yeah.
So in that vein to what Laura said, absolutely, you can't legally do freeze distillation without a distiller's license. If you've got a distiller's license, you could do it.
Then you go nuts, but otherwise, okay, see, and I'd never heard that before, so this is another episode where I get to learn something new, and hopefully everybody watching does too, because I'm loving this type of information. This is fantastic. I actually didn't know, so I worked at a liquor store for a handful of years, not one that, actually, for 11 years, about a very long time to work at one place, honestly. But we had that Tactical Nuclear Penguin was, I think I said that right, yeah, sitting in the lockup case.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I remember looking at that all the time, especially, you know, because I was like 22. I'm like, man, a 32% beer sounds right up my alley. I think I got to try this. And
what could go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. Never actually ended up getting to try it, but I didn't realize that that's how that one was made, is actually by doing the icing of it. That's really cool.
Another piece of learning about beer is seeing what it will do in a distillation form and distill it and how you want to aim at what your flavors are and things like that. But just, it's not fermentation only. So,
so then how are you?
So our strong beers are definitely, they 100%. Get, 100%. Well, from it, I mean, there's, when you age a beer in a barrel, there is a very modest concentration that occurs because, it's in distilled spirits in barrels. They call it the angel's share.
Yep.
But if you think about as I understand it anyway, I could be mistaken, but as I understand it, the relative concentration of water and ethanol when you've got, like, say it's a whiskey.
Yep.
When you've got a, like a cask strength whiskey, you know, that is typically in the area of 60 to 70% alcohol.
Yeah.
So also that would mean broad strokes, 30 to 40% water. So it's roughly 2/3 alcohol, 1/3 water.
Yep.
And so more ethanol sneaks out, evaporates out of that barrel than water.
Yeah.
Just kind of because of the numbers game.
Yep.
But in sort of mirror image, inverted parallel, with beer, even a very strong beer is going to be in that, say, 10 to 20% range.
Yep.
Which means it's 80 to 90% water. And so more water evaporates out of that barrel than alcohol.
Alcohol, yeah.
So typically you get a very modest, depending on how long you're in the barrel and the temperature, humidity, blah, 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 the surrounding environment, but you might gain a half a percent or a percent of alcohol because of those sorts of things.
Okay.
So you get a slight concentration there, but most of the alcohol content in our strong beers is just from trying to manage a fermentation to give us a beer that's very strong.
Okay.
So you were saying before, you know, the barrel being the point of making it into a double digit beer. I mean, one of our Wayne's brands that he's done now for 23 years is a Russian Imperial Stout that does go through barrel aging, but the base beer of it is generally 17 to 17.5% just
from the fermentation. Just
from the fermentation, and then it goes through the processes of barrel aging. We've also brewed it to higher strength as well, but
We've been able to push the fermentation to close to 20% on a couple of occasions. And so then when you get a little extra concentration from the barrel aging, then that almost instantly puts it up over 20.
So is that just the particular strains of yeast? Is that the types of grain? Like, what? There's got to be a lot that goes into that.
There are a lot of things that go into it. I had sort of referred loosely earlier to a lot of the research I was doing going back to the late 80s, throughout the 90s, the aughts. And I mean, frankly, I'm still learning today. Managing yeast is managing living creatures, and as a person who sometimes tries to exercise to stay fit, I have trouble actually properly managing one single living creature. So managing a bajillions of yeast cells is challenging, but there's been an awful lot of research that I've done over the decades, you know, reading about sake fermentations, reading about improved understandings of yeast strains based on research to find out how to, because of course the big guys love it too, I mean, for different reasons. If they can ferment, fill in the industrial light lager name, doesn't matter.
Yep.
If they can ferment that stuff to say 10 or 15%, instead of 4 or 5%.
Cut it back down with the water.
They cut it back down with water, but it also means that, because remember, during the time they're doing that, that is in a sanitary stainless steel tank.
Yeah.
Those ain't free, and they are big, and it's refrigerated.
Yeah.
That is also not free. So if they can do a smaller quantity of liquid and then just inject more water down the line, it's an immense water save. And hey, they get to say they're more green, which is not false, but also mainly it saves them a lot of money. Being able to do higher alcohol fermentations is a topic that has interest for a number of different places for a number of different reasons. I mean, for me, it's not so I can make a 15% industrial light lager.
Yeah.
It's so I can try to make a really characterful, fill in the blank, imperial stout, barley wine, old ale, Belgian strong ale of the various families, Doppelbock, and fill in the blank, saisons, etc. And just have a different and richer character in these beers. So there's been a lot of learning and research on trying to figure out how to get the yeast to do that.
Yeah. And that's, like you said, because same thing, right? I'm constantly convincing myself, I'm going to go work out multiple times this week and then don't actually make it happen as much as I want. much to the chagrin of my daughter, who, shout out to her, going into her freshman year, has pulled herself out of bed at 5:30 every morning to go do summer workouts for her softball team. So
solid.
She's kicking my butt right now. I'm way behind the eight ball when it comes to
that's awesome.
But I can't imagine trying to manage that, like, be able to pay that much attention. Because I also know that yeast is very, very temperamental, as I've tried to make a couple of pizza doughs, and they've just completely fallen apart on me.
You know, just when, again, that's what I find. Just when I think I've really learned quite a bit about it and I've got a pretty good handle on things, something happens differently from what I expect, which then basically fundamentally makes me say, well, perhaps I didn't really understand that very well. There's more going on than I previously understood. I've got more to learn. And that has been for 30-some years of professional brewing and a few years of home brewing before that.
Yeah.
That has been essentially one constant presence in my experience of the brewing process, is that learning about the yeast and how they play is a never-ending experience.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I can imagine that there's always going to be something more to learn. It's one of the, but that also, I think, makes probably a lot of working in this industry something that's really exciting to do, because it's not, you're never just going to be like stale and on the same thing all the time. There's always going to be something new to experiment with and try out and learn, like, well, this worked for a while, but now there's something else that's, you know, a little different. I do have a question about the fermentation, because I know in distilleries a lot of times, I just went and talked to Snitching Lady Distillery up in Fairplay, and he does all of his fermentation open tank, because he likes to get some of the influence from what happens. Obviously, he also said in that episode it makes a big difference around like spring, summertime, because there's just so much more in the air.
Sure.
In the winter, there's a lot less. Do you do an open tank as well? Is it closed tank? I'm curious how that works here.
The high alcohol fermentations that I do are 100% closed.
Makes sense.
There's an awful lot of parallel with distilling.
Yep.
And essentially, the first part of the process is broad strokes, more or less parallel enough to say identical.
Yeah.
It's not strictly true, but close enough in broad strokes. But what I would say as well is, like, if you think about it, you'll see stuff like, you know, sour mash,
mm-hmm.
right? Sour mash whiskey,
yep.
That's a common term. I will suggest that, at least in my experience, if I drink a you know, one of the, say, Jack Daniels, right? Sour mash, right? When I taste Jack Daniels, I don't particularly taste sourness.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's got plenty of flavors. I don't mean to cast any stones at Jack Daniels at all, but I don't literally taste sourness.
Right, that's fair.
And so part of what's going on there is the distillation process. That changes the liquid that you are actively working with in a very fundamental manner.
Yeah.
You're leaving an awful lot of the liquid behind.
Yep.
And also some of the physical and aromatic flavor components. And so that is, I think, a fundamental manner in which, and I'm no expert on sour mash distillation. I don't, yeah, so if I get something wrong there, hey, I own it and I apologize. But I will suggest that you're getting some fun aromas and flavors out of it, as I understand it, the person was referring to.
Yep.
But you're not actually, when you're drinking the spirit, now you might put a sour mixer in there, you know, whiskey sour or whatever, you know, or whatever, but you're not actually drinking something, to my awareness, where the acidity, the pH of it, is aggressively sour. And that's because of some of the separation that occurs during the distillation process.
Yeah.
So I believe that's true. If I'm mistaken, I apologize in advance. But and so it's, as I understand it, more about trying to create some interesting aroma, flavor, character in your spirit, rather than to actually make your spirit sour.
Right.
And so, however, if you don't distill it, that liquid's going to be sour.
Okay.
So that liquid would be like the beer.
Yep.
So unless you wanted it to be willfully sour, doing that wild open fermentation, or even if you're adding some yeast but still allowing it to be open,
yeah.
Or if you're allowing your mash to be open and soured, you know, sour mashing, right? These sorts of things. If you're not then at some point distilling your product, the liquid is going to be fundamentally more similar to a, you know, a famous place out in Oregon, Cascade Barrel House, just closed.
Okay.
They are well known for making assertively sour barrel-aged beers.
Yeah.
And I don't believe anyone would mistake whether or not those beers are tart. And whereas, again, as I say, if I sip on a sip of a sour mash whiskey, I don't believe I would have the impression, oh boy, that's really tart. You know, it might be flavorful,
gotcha.
But it might. So, it's, again, if I'm mistaken, I apologize, but I think that's a fair amount of the mechanics going on there. They're
yeah.
looking to develop some interesting flavor and aroma that carries through into the spirit. They're not actually trying to make the spirit flat out sour.
Right, no, for sure. Definitely
and
not.
So that's, but that would be different if you did a beer that way. It would be flat out sour.
Okay.
And so that's why we don't do our strong fermentations we've actually had some dialogue with a place up near Fort Collins that is deeply connected with the history of the sour beer movement in the U.S. about possibly trying to do a very high alcohol barrel-aged sour beer with them.
Okay.
And it's still something we're sort of kicking around and thinking about and trying to parse out, because the souring critters in the barrel are not necessarily very alcohol tolerant. If you think, the majority of sour beers are not very strong.
Yeah, that's, yep.
And so we're still kicking some ideas around, but there are just, again, beer is, to my perspective, an endlessly intriguing, and every time I feel like I've done a whole bunch of things, if I just happen to also like look over here, I'm like, oh my God, now I could do 10,000 more things, kind of a deal. There's just so much to potentially try to learn and play with.
Okay, absolutely. I do want to talk a little bit about the actual barrel influences that you guys get as well. Before we move forward with that, I do have to give the shout out to our sponsor for the show.
Hello everybody, before we continue with today's episode, I just want to take a quick moment to talk to you all about Centennial Cuts. Centennial Cuts is a Colorado-owned company. They've been growing beef here in the state of Colorado, down in southeast Colorado, for generations. The Larson family has been doing this forever, and they make some of the best beef that you will ever have. That is any type of beef that you can really think of. They've got all the best roast cuts, they've got all the best steak cuts, they've got fantastic, and I mean fantastic, ground beef. You can also get beef jerky, you can get all beef hot dogs, and you can even get pet treats. Anything beef, they've got it at Centennial Cuts. You can purchase from them down at their store in Colorado Springs, or even more convenient, head over to centennialcuts.com, put in promo code MHBR, get 10% off of your first order, and then have it shipped directly to your door. That's right, you don't have to go anywhere. You get the best beef delivered directly to your door, so you can then throw it directly on your grill. Centennial Cuts, like I said, is absolutely phenomenal beef. My whole family loves it. Everybody I've cooked it for loves it. And you can even find them in some of the top steakhouses in the state. So be sure to check them out. Thank you to Centennial Cuts for sponsoring today's episode. And make sure that you go over to centennialcuts.com. Use that promo code MHBR, Mile High Bourbon Rye, MHBR. Save 10% off of your first order. Have it delivered right to your door. Again, thank you, Centennial Cuts. And now back to today's episode. Cheers.
And thank you so much to them for supporting me, because otherwise I don't get to do cool interviews like this if it's not for folks like that and everybody here that's watching. So let's go ahead and talk more about the barrels, because obviously, you know, the yeast, the grain, and all of that, we've already kind of touched base on how that influences a lot of the flavors. What do you see you gain, lose, change? What all does the barrel do, especially to these stronger beers?
Well, it actually, we're pretty careful about barrels that we use. We make sure that we've tasted the product before we use the barrel. That being said, all barrels are different. So even within one brand, specific beer can come out with heavier oak flavors or heavier vanillins than another barrel in the same family. And so it's important for us to understand the liquid that the intent of the distiller before we dive into using their barrel, because it says a lot about what we're going to experience from barrels to know what the intent of the distiller was, and also what kind of it's one thing to say I'm going to put it in a barrel, I'm going to get flavors of oak, I'm going to get flavors of vanilla. That's basically true for all barrels.
Just about.
You will get heavier levels of char based on whether or not the char is heavier in the barrel, or obviously no level of char if it's new oak. And when we're looking for components to match with our strong beers or even some of the lower alcohol beers that we've put into barrels, we're looking for a match with the flavors that we're trying to exhibit in the product. And sometimes we design specifically to go into barrels, and sometimes we design the product essentially designs itself. Okay. So for example, this Solar Eclipse is the name of the brand that Wayne's been doing now for 23 years, Russian Imperial Stout. And when he was making it in Michigan, the barrels that he was able to get were from Heaven Hill Distillery in Kentucky. Again, not many people clamoring for barrels. I don't believe that Heaven Hill even made a distinction, like, here, have a barrel, kind of thing. Nobody really cared.
They were free. The barrels were free.
Wow.
Yeah, so they just handed them over, and nobody really cared. Like, nobody said, hey, what kind of barrel did you use on that?
Yeah.
They were just like, barrel aging. And so when we decided to make it here starting 6 years ago, we wanted to go with a local distillery. So we used Laws, and we used their four-grain bourbon barrels so that it kind of ties into our community. And then we decided to take it further. Solar Eclipse has always been single barrel aged, Russian Imperial Stout, landing around anywhere between 18 and 19.5%.
Okay.
Before the barrel.
Before the barrel, yeah.
And then, of course, after the barrel, it gains, you know, probably about a percent from what's in the barrel and how long we barrel age it. And then we decided that we would take it further. We would explore what a barrel was going to give to the process of creating a flavor in the beer. So as Burns Family Artisan Ales in creating Solar Eclipse, Solar Eclipse always has a bourbon barrel on the first, that's the brand name.
Okay.
Solar Eclipse, bourbon barrel aged Russian Imperial Stout. Then we decided we would put it into a single malt barrel for its second barrel aging, always different every year, every iteration. Okay. And then it kind of comes full triangle back to a Heaven Hill barrel. And in our case, we use Elijah Craig because we can choose.
In this day and age, yeah. Yes. Of course, we have to pay for it.
Right. And then we've also taken it further. It's gone through four barrel aging, five barrel aging. We haven't taken it to six yet. But each time it comes, you know, we're tasting it as it's in the barrel, allowing the barrel to do its own expression in the beer, and then we take it out when we feel like we like what it tastes like. So that's kind of a the barrel approach to defining flavors within the beer product, as opposed to what I was talking about before, when we choose barrels so that it can accentuate the actual flavor in the beer. So we've chosen to do a series of barley wines that are aged in, one is aged in brandy barrels, one is aged in tequila barrels, one is aged in rye whiskey barrels. One is aged in gin barrels, and I think that's as far as we've gotten with that series. But specifically, it is the same barley wine.
Yeah.
So same brewed barley wine. We just
put it in different barrels. Same tank of beer, and then split it into those different barrels.
And what we're looking for then is the design. The barley wine tastes like this, and we hope to get, in the example of tequila, tequila is funny because tequila doesn't offer actual tequila flavor. It offers very earthy mineral notes.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're expecting to get when we pull that barley wine out of that barrel, as opposed to the very fruity aspect of a cognac barrel. So we're looking at two very same beer that went into it, literally the same beer.
Yeah.
And we're expecting these different flavors based on the barrel choice that we're making. So it's loads of fun. Barrels are known as the fifth ingredient. You know, Reinheitsgebot kind of way when you're talking about malt, hops, yeast, water, and then a barrel to add the fifth ingredient. And largely we don't use adjuncts in our beer. We don't, I think we've got a very small examples of beers that have adjuncts in them, like vanilla or something like that, that have been also barrel aged.
Okay.
Just because exploring what the barrel is too much fun.
Yeah.
So,
well, yeah, and I think one of the things that's also worth highlighting is that, also different woods are fascinating as well, but even just within the world of oak, which of course is the dominant wood that is used, different types of oak from different regions, and one of the things, though, that I believe is often not thought of as much is, well, okay, I'm painting in really broad strokes here, but there are a lot of factors, and so I don't mean to downplay the other ones, but I think two of the obvious strokes that are there are the toast level and the char level. And I think most people tend to sort of in their minds lump those together.
Okay.
And they're actually distinctly different things, and they bring out different things from the wood. The char level is the actual, like, burnt level, and you can, you know, as a distiller, you can order your barrel at different levels of intensity of the burn, of the char. But you can also get different levels of the toasting, which is a much lower temperature dynamic, and the toasting tends to bring out a lot of the spicy, so folks who wrote a book on barrel aging beer, very experienced folks, Pete Buchert and Dick Cantwell, they talked about how walking around a facility, and they were just looking around, touring, talking with people for a couple of hours, and they said they started to actually feel full because of all the toasting aromas. So all of these spice aromas, like vanilla. Vanilla is the most obvious one, but there are, you know, any number of other classic spicy aromas that you can think of that you often perceive in many spirits, but especially whiskeys, cinnamons and other things like these sort of rich, flavorful, spicy aromas, those drive to a fair degree out of the toasting level rather than the charring level. And so one of the distillers that we've worked with on more than one occasion out of Buena Vista here in Colorado,
Deerhammer,
he doesn't like, or at least this is what he told me when he dropped off some barrels here a few years ago. He prefers a very high toast level, but he prefers a moderate char level.
Okay.
So he doesn't like his spirits to be dominated by the char. He likes the more spicy, for lack of a better broad stroke term, character of the toastiness rather than the charness. And so I think that just, it highlights some of the different things you can get out of different whiskey producers, or maybe different brands within the same whiskey producer if they use different things for different brands of theirs. But then that stuff also comes to play if, as a brewery, we purchase some of those barrels from these folks, And then we age a beer in them. And the fact of, oh, was this a very high char or a modest char? Was this a very high toast or a modest toast?
Yeah.
And then, of course, the other thing, okay, what kind of oak is it and from where? And these, I mean, there are an awful lot of things, but those sorts of dynamics can show up in subtle ways in the beer after you age it for some months in this wood barrel. Perhaps we're interested in bringing out some spiciness on our rich old ale to bring an extra layer of character over around this way or from the side on this thing. And so that's part of, I think, the fun of what Laura was talking about in terms of we find the barrels themselves to be very, very much fun. And we find we do it sometimes, adding like a flavor or a handful of flavors. It's fine, and if we do it, we try to do it very well and very balanced, but we find it more interesting to add the fifth ingredient, the wood barrel, along with the time in the wood barrel, to bring out a whole portfolio of more subtle nuance, but an awful lot of things in the beer as extra characters of the beer. We find that just almost, I don't have a good enough palate to tease out all those nuances, but I keep trying to get better at it. But it's there's so many fascinating, tiny, nuanced characters that you can bring into what's already. I mean, Imperial Stouts, or any of these strong beers, Belgian quads, barley wines, whatever. Many of these big, rich, strong beers, they're already like, before you even put them in any kind of wood aging, they're very complex beers with an awful lot going on. And so then when you also bring that very complex beer into this environment where all of these other influences are there, you've got extra time, you've got some micro-oxidation occurring, you've got all these other things happening. I sadly will not live remotely long enough to run all the experiments I would love to run.
I think you'd have to, you're going to have to be pushing, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000, I think, before you'd be able to get every one of the experiments that sounds like you'd be interested in running.
Sure.
I mean, I can tell, and this is just from my own enjoyment of sitting here talking to you guys right now, like, it's very clear that you've got an intense passion and love for what you do, like, I can see it in your face as you're talking about it, and I really appreciate that because I think it just makes
cheers to that.
Makes some great beers for sure. So
thank you.
I mean, this has been absolutely awesome. The last thing I kind of want to talk about and just touch base on is what Laura, you were telling me when I first came in here. You guys, you can see some behind me. We've got some photos on the wall. I'll add some pictures on. They've got an awesome mural here by local artists. I mean, so you guys, in addition to working with other like local distilleries, and then obviously you guys are a Colorado company as well, and I think you touched on this a little bit earlier, you're really trying to build and be that sort of community, that inclusive spot, and just really support. I mean, I personally love that. So I'll add a picture up of the mural, but tell me a little bit your bar top and the mural on the wall here.
Sure. So the chalk mural is what you're mentioning, and we also have a chalk mural bar top from a local artist, Corbin Hillam, who also does children's illustrations and children's books, and has done a lot with the Chalk Art Festival in downtown Denver, which is a lot of fun. Fun to go to if no one has. And that was a person that I met when I was working at the place that I was working in preparation to open Burns Family Artisan Ales, and kind of noodling on what I wanted my bar top to look like. And then it just came together when he said, you know, I do chalk. And I said, why? I think that might be a great idea. I'll cover it with some glass and it'll be great. And then another friend of mine, when I was working at the same place, is Mark Whittefield, did our bar front, and he made it out of the ends of 2x4s. And then kind of he modified it as he went along to create a wave. Water is strong in my background. and then singed it to create the Burns part. So very, very creatively addressed and up to and including our landlords offering him some 2x4 wood that was old. So he got tremendously excited about the rings and placing those, and so he had to take things apart and then put it back together again, and just a work of art.
I guess the wood patterns in old 2x4s are way cooler.
And
interesting.
And then as a result, I mean, we've always been art focused. What we do is an art, and it's one form of art. I kind of came into this creative process for brewing from being a chef. So visual art is beyond my scope. And so we got to know people as we went along. The photographs behind us are the gentleman who takes these photographs, not only being a skilled nature photographer, is also our connection to get some of the malt that we use. And so, you know, just kind of the connections start happening. We have one of the rooms that we have is filled with cosplay wings and some mixed media two-dimensional art. And that's a person who's been very closely involved in helping Burns Family Artisan Ales be Burns Family Artisan Ales. We've got some oil paintings in the other. It's a drawing together of the community that, you know, also allows us to present our product in a environment that is more experiential, that is full of, as you mentioned, the passion that we have behind our art, but it's visual at this point.
Yeah.
You know, we try to make our experiences experiential. So, you know, putting people in an environment where they're appreciating what's going on around them is super important too. And for that, we trust other people with their skills to bring that into play. So
I can tell you, when I walked in, I definitely think that trusting other people with that has paid off immensely, because it's very, and not just because it's 98 degrees out, but it's very warm and inviting feeling, but it feels very, like craft done at the same time. I mean, you've definitely, I think, created a spot that mirrors, like you were saying, what your art isn't necessarily a visual art, but what you've done around here mirrors all of the love and passion that you put into the beers that you guys produce as well. So
thank you. We hope so, and that's definitely with gratitude to the folks who are visual artists who have helped us out. So
which is so cool, because again, I like, big thing all the time is always trying to make sure that it's Colorado, it's local supported, it's bringing all the people together, because, you know, the folks that are doing the chalk art stuff, that are taking the photos and everything, like, I can't take a picture that good. I've got a phone, it's got a good camera on it, it's not going to look like that. So being able to support the folks that can do things like this, or your chandelier, which the guy's dragging wood, big chunks of wood down to then turn them into chandeliers. I mean, I'll add a picture of those up as well, but it is, I mean, it's really cool just what's sort of been created around here. So
yeah.
I'm
definitely for anyone who's visiting, these are all purchasable products except for the chalk art. You'll have to contact the artist if you want your own chalk art done. That kind of stays with us, but anything, you know, two-dimensional or any of the products that are found wood artist does are all purchasable from our tap room.
So come down, support a couple of local beer artists, and support some other local artists at the same time.
Absolutely.
Because that's what all of this is ultimately about, is finding delicious beverages to consume and enjoy while supporting people who are local to here. That's really what I want to have happen, and you guys are embodying that quite perfectly. So well, thank you guys so much for joining me. I mean, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Thanks for asking us.
Yeah, I'm thrilled that you guys were able to sit down. Before we take off, let people know where they can find you, both online and physically.
Absolutely. The best place you can find us is in our tap rooms. One is located, the one that we're taking these photos in right now, that is 2505 West Second Avenue, units 13 and 12. We take up two units, but the address is 13, and that is in Denver, Colorado. We have a second location that we call the Tap House. The original location is called the Barrel House. Second location, the Tap House, is 1236 South Broadway. And that is also in Denver, street-facing location for that one, so no need to look for units. We are also located at some bottle shops around town. For that, I would suggest you go to our website, which is www.burnsalesdenver.com, so burnsalesdenver.com. And take a look at those locations there. Make sure to give them a call before you go just to make sure that they might have the product that you want. We have our menu online that we keep so that you know what to expect when you come into our tap room. And yeah, that's it.
Awesome. So this one's going to be airing November-ish. Right. What's going to be the beer to come down and have?
Oh, wow. That would be Ship of Theseus.
Okay.
That always releases around our Thanksgiving time frame. So Ship of Theseus is what you're looking for. Ship of Theseus is based on a beer that Wayne won gold at both the World Beer Cup and at the Great American Beer Festival. And while not being that same exact beer, it got its name from the thought experiment. You guys will have to look that one up. And and also we will have just started to produce many of the holiday beers that we come up with. We have a range of seven different holiday beers, so that kind of starts in that time frame.
Perfect.
So, yeah.
A lot of the big, strong barrel-aged beers come out around that time of the year.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Perfect to sit down. I mean, there's not a lot that's better. Obviously, whiskey as well, but a nice strong beer, barrel aged especially, sitting by a fire, snow falling outside, kind of a perfect. Man, I could go for that so much right now as we're topping 100 degrees all week this week.
Just a couple of snowflakes.
Yeah, just a few. Just give me a couple.
Warm out.
Yep. So that's awesome. Thank you guys so much. Definitely
Absolutely.
Check them out. Burns Family Artisan Ales. Phenomenal, phenomenal beer. If you've been enjoying the show, give us subscribe to us on YouTube, follow us on your podcast channels. We're on Apple, we're on Spotify, we're on Good Pods, wherever you listen to podcasts, find us, subscribe, give us reviews, give us ratings. All of these things help us to grow. The more I grow, the more conversations like this I get to have, the more everybody gets to find out about awesome places to come visit and try delicious beer, spirits, everything as far as it goes.
Absolutely.
And just keep growing that Colorado community. So. Give us a follow on social media, at Mile High Bourbon on all the platforms, just Mile High Bourbon, and give us a follow that way. Special shout out to Roma Ransom. They are a local Colorado band. They do the intro, outro music for us. Find them at Roma Ransom on Instagram to find out where they're playing next. They'll play distilleries a lot of times. They play breweries a lot of times. And so give them a follow, check out where they're playing, and go check them out. And then shout out to my family's business in Fairplay as well, because they've supported a lot of being able to get this set up to a lot of the kind of art and design and everything. So Kickin' Ass Mountain Pizza up in Fairplay, check them out. I'm hoping they'll be open by the time this one releases again. So always give them the support. And as always, thank everybody. Thank you all for joining us. And Laura and Wayne, thank you guys so much.
Cheers. Thanks, Zach. Yeah.
Thank you.